Welcome to the Creative Gap Podcast. Glad to have you here, and today we have another great episode. But before we dive into the conversation, I want to give a quick thank you to our sponsor, MusicBed. Creativity comes to me when I get a sense of inspiration, and lately that is due to MusicBed. I'm sure you have heard me talk about them before, so take this as a sign to switch to MusicBed. Here's why I switched over. Music is made by real working musicians and artists. It's not just stock music that is made with no emotion or skill. These songs are the product of true musicianship. With over 50,000 songs, selecting the right song is so easy with MusicBed's platform. I don't have to spend a ton of time digging to find the right song, but I find 3 to 4 options that work every single time. I'm more inspired as a creative using MusicBed, and I want that for you. For a limited time, MusicBed is offering a free 14-day trial so you can see the difference for yourself. Switch to MusicBed today with the link in the show notes. Let's welcome to the show cinematographer Robert Machado. Rob Machado, welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
I'm good. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I want to start this off with a bit of a light question, and I don't know if you get this often. How often do you get confused with the surfer?
You know, I get that. I actually end up getting a lot. I remember the first time I saw the movie Surf's Up, there's like a, you know, the cameo of Rob Machado, and everyone, we were watching that movie in middle school. Everyone was like, oh, it's you. And then, you know, yeah. I end up getting that a lot. I think there's also a baseball player named after me too. So One of the two, I usually get asked if I'm related somehow, but completely different ethnicity.
Totally.
Right. Yeah. Aside.
But yeah, I thought that was funny when I think the first time I looked you up a while ago, the surfer just popped up. I'm like, oh, all right, he's a great surfer. It's a tough act to follow.
Sure, yeah, great. Totally. Yeah. Not one of my skill sets. But.
Yeah, but the more I learned about you and started following your work, and, you know, I realized that you weren't in LA, you were in Vegas. I was curious to, like, what brought you to Vegas? Were you born and raised there? And, like, kind of what that industry is like out there?
Yeah, I mean, I was born and raised out here, so I've been here all my life, and, you know, I've come to really enjoy it. And, you know, a lot of people see Vegas as a, you know, a big tourist destination with all the glitz and glam, and they see it in movies. But, you know, to me, it's, you know, a place that I call home, so kind of holds a really special place in my heart. So the Vegas is, you know, in actuality, Vegas is actually a pretty small town in relation to, you know, something like L.A., to whereas you could be end to end in, you know, half an hour of the city. So you can, you know, drive 30 minutes one way and you're completely, you know, outside of the city. So that's one thing I really like about Vegas. And the film community itself, you know, is an even smaller community. You know, we all know each other on a first name basis, which is really nice. So, you know, whereas in, you know, you go to LA, it's like there are so saturated. There's just so many people, right. And which is nice. So there's a lot of diversity out in LA, but it's really cool being able to know everyone here in town, you know, on a first name basis.
Was it tough starting out in Vegas with, you know, it being, you know, a smaller market? And did you start off initially wanting to, you know, just pursue DPing, or did you come up the ladder in a more traditional sense?
Yeah, so I don't know that it was necessarily harder. I think it's just a different market. Like here in Vegas, there's just a ton of corporate work, and there's a ton of like those events because things are always coming in to Vegas. So in that sense, there's plenty of work. There's almost too much work, and there's way more work even for us. So, you know, in my experience, I always find you know, a lot of crews end up coming into Vegas to work a lot of these events. In terms of the commercial sense, it's, you know, it's a little bit different. And I think it's just, we have plenty of work. It's just kind of, it's a lot different than what you would typically find, I think, from LA. And in terms of my whole career path, I kind of always knew I wanted to be behind a camera somehow. Like at first I really wanted to be like a Steadicam operator, and then it kind of was like, okay, I really like, you know, camera operating in general. But then, you know, then I started kind of DPing a lot of my own stuff. And so I didn't necessarily climb the ladder like a lot of people do. I have AC'd before, but honestly, I probably AC'd, you know, I could probably count on one hand the amount of times I AC a year.
Yeah.
So, and it's, you know, it's just a completely different world. And after working with a lot of my regulars out in LA, it's like, you know, industry ACs, they're just on a completely other level. It's really, you know, fun and refreshing, like getting to work with them. And, you know, even people here from Vegas, like we, like you know, when you have like a legit AC that just has everything
right
taken care of, and you know, you can worry less about this little one cable, and it's super refreshing. Yeah.
That's amazing. I feel the same exact way. I think I don't AC at all anymore, but I think I did it maybe 3 times in my whole life. And I don't think I'm fit for that particular job. And that job is like so particular. It's so technical. But when I get to work with some of my favorite ACs, it literally makes my life so much easier. It's insane. I mean, same with Gaffer and Key Grip as well.
Yeah, any department, those, really.
Yeah, those positions are, you know, I tip my hat off to them because they have such a difficult job, but they make us look good. And I feel similar to my market in Philly, where I work probably, you know, 40% of my jobs are based in Philly. It's such a tight community. I know everyone by name. We all know each other. And it's great to be able to work with, you know, the same people and, you know, have a couple different crews, but all of them are so close. And when you arrive on set, it's like seeing your friends. It's one of my favorite.
You're already past the kind of, you know, getting to know each other. Exactly. There's already a rapport there with them. And so it's like, it just makes hitting the ground just way easier and faster.
Right. You said you wanted to start as a Steadicam operator. So how did you even get into that to begin with? Like what did you start with? Was it, were you always into video?
So,
were you like the Super 8 kid? Like
I wasn't quite Super 8 kid, but I was that kid in high school who like always had a camera around their neck. So
that's,
I remember,
amazing.
Starting in about 10th grade, that was, I think, when I first got my first DSLR, and that was right along the 5D wave. So it was a Canon T1i, and it was amazing for me at the time. The video in hindsight was just garbage. It was garbage, not that because it was a Rebel camera, because for some reason in video mode, you couldn't change any of your settings. And like it was stuck in program mode, so like you couldn't change your shutter speed, you couldn't change your iris, you literally just couldn't change your exposure. It was just an auto. And so I remember I was first starting out, like just playing around with the video modes, and I was like, and people on YouTube were like, yeah, just change your shutter speed to this. And then I was like, how do you do that? I don't know how to do that. And I thought I was missing something. So I always find that a little bit funny, because a lot of people either start out on a T2i or a T3i, and starting from the T2i, you could like change all your settings. But
right.
The T1i, it was just like, hey man, I'm in auto, and that's what you're going to get. So that was my first camera, and I've been doing it since high school. So,
amazing.
And I kind of, my background, I would really kind of consider is really in stills. So I loved kind of photojournalism, and again, I was always that kid with that camera around his neck, and I just loved just capturing moments. And, you know, I wasn't in the yearbook class, but they would always use a lot of my pictures in the yearbook. And, I grew so many memories with, you know, just having a camera around my neck. And, you know, and it's nice because, you know, at that age, you know, I'm what, 15 or 16 years old, like you can make mistakes, and it's like,
right,
there are literally zero stakes. And it's like, you're not on a professional job just trying to, you know, learn shutter speed or anything like that. So it's like, I always consider myself very fortunate and grateful that I found this, at a very early age, and to where it's like, you know, look where it's led me now.
Right. Do you think you still have like the same passion that you had when you were in high school? Like you carry, you know, you used to carry the camera around your neck, and now that you do it for work, obviously every minute of every day is, you know, surrounded by this type of work. Do you still find you have the same passion when you're not working? to hold a camera?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. It's funny, whenever I think about it, whenever I travel or whenever I'm, whenever I have a camera with me in my personal life, it's usually just a stills camera. I don't usually ever do video outside of my professional life. And I, you know, I haven't really thought about it, but it, you know, it could get come down to the editing. It could come down to photos are more shareable, but what it probably is, you know, just kind of going back to my roots as, you know, as my, for my love for photography, you know, in itself. So, you know, capturing an image is, you know, it's, you know, a moment in time. And, in a lot of cases takes, you know, a lot less effort than setting up a whole camera and, you know, getting in NDs, getting all my settings right and stuff like that. So not saying that photography is easy, but, I just love the medium of photography and right. still imagery. And you know, I love it just as much as video. And I think it's just another way for us to communicate, share stories.
Mm. Yeah. I used to be similar where if I wasn't working, I would still carry my camera and shoot video. But I think now I've gotten to the point where I don't even know if I carry a camera at all. I just use my iPhone for almost everything.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
But I still hold the same passion. I think it's grown tremendously. I think the deeper that I get into it, the more that I find out about myself and like what's possible and what I'm capable of. Do you find that your passion has evolved throughout the years?
My passion for
cinematography,
itself?
Yeah, for the craft, for, you know, figuring out how to make the best looking images or just filmmaking in general.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think it you know, continually is just always becoming stronger. It's like a lot of times that passion is reinforced whenever I feel super inspired from, you know, a specific piece of artwork. In recent memory, I can just think of Dune Part 2. Mm. Like last night was the second time I saw it this week. And it's like, not many movies can literally force me to go back to the theater and watch a 3-hour long movie again and have just as much fun as I did the first time. So it's like, whenever I see stuff like that, it's like, you know, it inspires me to do better. And whenever I think that FedEx guy is here. I'll be right back. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Sorry to cut you off.
No worries. No worries. How was the FedEx delivery? It was good.
It was good. He came by earlier and caught me totally off guard. Like my box wasn't ready because I totally just forgot about it. And so I was like, come back later. And it was crazy, but we're all good now.
I think you were talking about Dune. Did you see it in IMAX?
I did. I did see it in IMAX. Yeah, it's crazy. That movie is just all spectacle, and it's probably some of the craziest stuff I've ever seen on screen. And I try not to be hyperbolic, but dang, that movie will for sure inspire you. And I love watching behind the scenes stuff. And so a lot of times I'm that person where, you know, I could be on the couch and I'll pause a behind the scenes video and I'll be like zooming in and it's like seeing what fixtures they're using, seeing what camera lenses they're using and what other grip equipment they're using. So I love getting into the nitty gritty like that. And especially at the highest level, just seeing how and why those creative choices are being made. Cause I always love, you know, getting in the mind of, you know, DPs and directors at the highest level and, you know, why they make the creative decisions that they do. And, you know, inevitably I'd like to think that that kind of helps transfer down to my work.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. Something that I've thought about a lot is as a DP that, you know, I only DP, I don't really crew at all. I never really get an opportunity to see other DPs work ever. Unless it's like on a behind the scenes video or whatever the case may be. How do you at this stage in your career when, you know a lot of information, you have a lot of technical knowledge and creative knowledge and skill and years of experience, find new ways of working or find new ways to try things, for example?
It's interesting. I think a lot of it comes down to what you just mentioned is through watching other DPs work. And honestly, a lot of it does come from YouTube nowadays. I think it can just depend on, you know, which DPs you are kind of taking information from. But, you know, there are a lot of different resources online too, whether YouTube obviously is probably the most available one, but, you know, things like Filmmakers Academy is a great one. I've learned a lot from, you know, Shane Hurlbut's, you know, workflows and practices and all the different lighting technologies that he's using. And oftentimes when I'm gearing up for, you know, kind of a bigger shoot, sometimes I will reference back to some of his videos on working with larger units and stuff like that. So, but you know, a lot of times now it's just like trying stuff. And I used to get super technical and precise and exact, but now, like the further on I get, the less I am about precision and the more I am about how does it make you feel? And, you know, what kind of emotion does this convey? And sometimes that kind of stuff is hard to quantify. That's a hard thing to describe. And a lot of times it's just looking at the monitor, and if it feels right for the piece or the story, then, you know, we'll go with it. But I mean, obviously that's one of the nice things about digital is you have immediate kind of feedback on what you're actually doing on set. And sometimes that's nice, and sometimes all I hear from client is, oh, it looks a little dark. And
too dark.
I think that's the battle that we all kind of face as cinematographers. Right. But
I think on that real quick though, I think the thing that I've found is, you know, a lot of times you get the monitors for clients, whether it's from a rental house, and not often are they necessarily calibrating it before every shoot. So the monitor itself might be off. So I've found that it's also part of my job, not necessarily to educate the client, but to be a reference point, to be like, hey, the image is too dark. And then I could be the one to say, okay, I could see how you know, see that through the monitor, but looking at the waveforms and looking at all this, the levels are actually at a good, you know, reasonable place. Do you find that you have to also kind of like educate a little bit sometimes?
I do. I find that works if the client is receptive to being receptive, because I did that on a job literally in January, and we were filming, at CES, at the big consumer electronics show. And we were filming a bunch of like TV screens. And I mean, anyone knows how, you know, difficult TV screens are to film, because now all of the 4K OLEDs are super bright, you know, over 1,000 nits plus, 2,000 nits, and they're just super bright against this, you know, dark booth. And, you know, we're trying to level out the exposures. And so I remember in this one instance, I was filming the screen, I was filming the shot. And no matter what I did, I could underexpose the shot by two stops. We would pull it back up on the computer. I had the producer over me. Yeah, that's definitely too bright. That's definitely overexposed. And I'm like, I underexposed it by two stops. What you're looking at, and I brought the footage up in Resolve, pulled up waveform, and it was a white screen. So granted, it was white, but the white was like at 60 IRE. I'm like, this needs to be like up here. And he was like, oh, it's definitely too bright. It's definitely too bright. So in that sense, it's like, okay, cool, whatever. I'll underexpose my shots by four stops. You got it. Whatever you want. And so, you know, again, back to my point, I think it only works when your client is willing to accept the fact that they're wrong and kind of learn about our technical craft. And not saying that we're always right as kind of image technicians, but, you know, sometimes I've had many, many times where people have just said it's too dark. So you know, it's a constant battle I think we all face. And
everyone,
again, calibrated monitors are also a very big part of that. And I'm so crazy right now so I'm gearing up for a big show next week. And I have Kalman, which is like a really super expensive calibration software, and that only runs on Windows. So I'm bringing my entire like Mac Pro, the big one, The Big Mac Pro, I'm bringing that with me over to LA just so I can calibrate each of the Video Village monitors and calibrate them myself, because God knows, I mean, I'm sure you've rented multiple monitors from a rental house and they all look different. So
I just finished something, was it last week, 2 weeks ago? I had 5 monitors on set and every one of them looked different. And it's so frustrating. It is.
It's super frustrating. And without having, you know, a reliable constant source of, you know, being calibrated, it's you're hitting a moving target. It's like, it's something that you're never going to achieve. So that's why I luckily it's a studio shoot. So it's like, we have the kind of prep time to be able to calibrate, you know, 4 or 5 plus monitors, but, most jobs, that's just impractical. It's just not an option. So, that's where it's nice of having your own monitor so that you can calibrate them and then you can bring your own calibrated monitors on set. But, it's really difficult when you're getting it from a rental house.
Yeah. I want to go back a little bit to what you were saying is to, in the beginning, you used to be super technical and now you try to base your cinematography off of more a feeling, emotion, or tone that you're trying to achieve. And I feel as though that comes from a place of confidence that you've achieved as a DP. When do you think, or like, can you pinpoint a moment where you started to feel confident in your abilities as a DP? And because I've talked to many aspiring DPs or people that are younger that are trying to become, and the biggest thing that I notice is that they lack a lot of confidence in what they want to try to create. And I struggled with that too in the beginning, for sure.
Yeah, totally. I think a lot of it, I don't know if I can pinpoint it to one specific moment, but I can kind of say that a lot of those decisions just start to happen a lot faster. So I don't know, you know, at the end of the day, there are still jobs where, you know, I'm nervous as hell the night before. And, you know, we have thought about it for months. You know, I've done prep for months, but the night before I'm like, oh no, it's like, I'm second. I even, you know, Roger Deakins, I've heard stories of him doing the same thing. So it's like, even the night before I'm like, I don't know if this is going to work here. Maybe I should I just change the entire like lighting setup for this whole exterior? And so it's like, you know, I'll doubt and second guess myself, you know, all the time too. And it's hard to really say before actually seeing it on the day. But, I mean, again, that's the importance of such a great crew too, is like, sometimes I feel like I put a little bit too much stress on myself, even just from a lighting standpoint, because, you know, that's what a gaffer is for. You know, a solid gaffer will be able to give you really solid recommendations to do in very specific scenarios. And I think the reason that I put a lot of pressure on myself to come up with most of, if not all of the lighting diagrams, all the lighting setups, is because in a lot of my previous work as I was coming up, like, I didn't have a gaffer. I didn't have that luxury of asking someone else, oh, what do you think we should do here? It's like, okay, well, I had to figure out on my own, you know, based off of the instruments that I have, like, what would be right for this scene, you know? So a lot of it was just kind of taking on that responsibility. And so as I kind of, you know, moved on to DPing slightly bigger shows, it's like, you know, I still sometimes kind of hold on to that, control. I really try not to, but, a lot of times I'll come in with like a pretty general idea of how I want to approach something. And then I'll literally lob it to the gaffer and, you know, ask them what they think. And is there anything else that you would want to do? Anything else you want to try? And, you know, it's really just about being a good collaborator too. It's like, just because you're the director of photography, you know, obviously you're, you know, in control of camera and lighting department, but like at the same time, you want to be a good collaborator and a good leader and someone that, isn't so, you know, who isn't,
authoritarian,
I can't even say it, but yeah, someone who doesn't someone that isn't just demanding complete and total control.
Almost like a dictator.
Just super micromanagey and, so yeah, just kind of,
I think you bring
open
up a good point of being a DP that a lot of people may not think of immediately, is more than half of your job is being a good leader. Is that something that took you a while to figure out how to be a good leader, how to communicate effectively? Or is that something that you kind of like maybe had in yourself? Because that was, for me, personally, I don't think that was something I ever really struggled with, was, you know, the leadership aspect. But I know some people, that is a big hurdle that they have to overcome, is trying to communicate their vision effectively to crew members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good question. I remember growing up, I was involved a lot in band, and I played trumpet for, you know, 6 or so years growing up. And I would always be in these like kind of leadership positions as like a section leader and eventually like a drum major. And so I was always kind of around those leadership roles. But I think at this point in my career, I always try to, you know, lead by example. And like, I would never ask someone to do something that I myself personally wouldn't do. The best instance I can think of is, you know, I was on a LA shoot last year. It was that week where it was just like flooding. It was just so much rain. And, you know, I was asking grips and electrics to set up some HMIs outside. And, you know, I was right out there with them because like, I felt bad for asking them to work out in this pour. It was pouring. And so like, you know, I was like, you know, I feel bad asking them to, you know, essentially do their job, but like I was out there helping them wrangle cable and set right. up ballasts and rain covers and stuff like that. So it's like, I'm always like, you know, even if I ask someone to do something that's, you know, involves a lot of work, like I'll be right there with you, kind of supporting mm-hmm. you. And because at the end of the day, it's like that, you know, order kind of came from me, but you know, I'm not just going to leave you high and dry. It's like, you know, let's get this done and let's do it together.
Right. I think that is literally the recipe to being a good leader. And I think it's so important as a DP to at least, if you're not, you know, have the natural ability to be a good leader, do some research and read some books. I've read a couple books on leadership, and it's been truly valuable in terms of getting myself on great terms with the crew and making sure that, you know, they know that I have their backs no matter what. They trust me, I trust them. So I think that's really amazing. And I think going with trust, I'm curious as to how you try to navigate your relationships with directors, because every director has their own personal style, has their own way of working. And us as DPs, we kind of have to be like, iguanas in a sense. We always have to kind of change our style in a way. Do you find that you also have a similar approach of you trying to be more fluid in your, in the way you work with different directors?
I mean, yeah. I mean, ultimately, it just depends on the piece that we're going for. And again, I think a lot of that comes down to pre-production and I think a lot of that comes down to pre-production. And a lot of times, I think references are pretty key to that too. So oftentimes I'll trade references with the director and then I'll have them send the references to me, and you know, we'll kind of make a Venn diagram and see, you know, which ones kind of land up in the middle. And I find that, you know, as long as we're on the same page with the visual style and approach of, you know, the short film or this TV show or this movie or this short, you know, I think as long as we're on the same page, I think everything usually tends to work out. But you know, it's difficult, I found, just finding key collaborators that I just 100% just mesh with, you know. Those to me are a little bit rare, and maybe that's just more telling of me and, you know, my kind of sense of storytelling. And you know, at, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, my approach is kind of the end all be all, but sometimes I always find that there's usually a little bit more of an efficient way to accomplish a certain, you know, task or anything. But sometimes the director or even the producers will just kind of have it in their head. And sometimes it's just like, okay, sure. And you know, sometimes I will try to sway their, you know, thought processes and opinions, and I'll try to do that as diplomatically as I can, but
yeah,
sometimes that doesn't always work out. So it's tough. You know, you have to be willing to, you have to be willing to be open to, you know, their vision, but you know, at the end of the day, it's like sometimes you just have to go with what you're given.
Right. I was going to ask, how deep do you go sometimes in fighting for like that creative idea that you have? Because sometimes I'll go pretty far in fighting for something if I truly believe it. And other times I'll back off, you know, a little bit quicker.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. I think it just depends on each scenario, right? I think that because sometimes I will fight for stuff more. And sometimes if I think that it's just not worth the fight in it for me, sometimes I'll just, you know, learn to let go. And it's almost like going back to, you know, what I said earlier about not being super technical. The analogy that I always go back to is Star Wars Episode 4, when Luke is going down the trench run and he's like using his targeting, you know, he turns off his targeting computer and, you know, they're calling him from the base, "Luke, you turned off your targeting computer. What's wrong?" And he's like, "Nothing, I'm all right." And he's basically using the force and learning how to let go of, you know, the technical know-how and just letting go of that and using the force and using your feelings and accomplishing it that way. And he blew up the Death Star. But a lot of times with that, it's like, you know, if I know that I'm just going to get so much pushback for this one kind of creative decision, then a lot of times I'll just let it go because it's, you know, I'd rather put that energy somewhere else rather than fighting, you know, for a way that I think that might serve the story a little bit better. But, you know, at the same time, if I think something is really worth it, then I will kind of, you know, I will be a little bit more upfront about pushing some of those creative decisions. But yeah, it's crazy how political and diplomatic like just being on a film set is. And a lot of people don't realize that it's like, it is crazy political how the hierarchy of, you know, above the line and agencies and producers, directors, like, you know, all the producers, it's a skill set in itself in navigating just the world of film sets and right. creative decision makings when other people's money is on the line to essentially make art.
Yeah. Have you ever had any aspirations of starting your own production company or even directing? Because a lot of DPs end up directing, but I never had that aspiration.
Lately, I can see how a lot of DPs end up directing because I think it's almost like to what I said earlier, it's like for me, it's hard to find key collaborators that I really just 1,000% drive with. So it's like, okay, well then I'll just direct myself. So in that sense, I could see it. But saying that, I myself don't have any aspirations of directing at all. Like that's not for me. For me, it's really strange. I almost feel like I feel like in my brain, I lack a lot of that kind of creative energy that the director has. And, you know, back to what I said earlier, it's like, I'm very technical and I know how to execute something, you know, to a very specific level. And so I always say that I'm a much better idea refiner than I am an idea creator.
Exactly.
So,
exactly. Yeah. I say the same thing. Yes. I love that.
Totally. And so it's like, it would be tough for me. It would definitely push me out of my comfort zone for sure. Directing, which is, you know, that's not always a bad thing, being out of your comfort zone. So, but at this point that one would be a hard for me to transition over to directing. I don't know that I would, at least not right now. I'm definitely not interested in any of that stuff.
Right. Yeah. Cinematography for me has been, it's like the one thing that I've done a bunch of different things prior outside of film, but this is like when I started, I knew that this was different. Something about it just drew me in and got me obsessed. What about cinematography do you love? Like, what is it that you love about cinematography?
I think it's just the fact that we're able to craft these images. I think the one time that it really did it for me is I was a camera utility on a movie from 2014, 2015 called Frank and Lola. And it was the first time that I had looked at a monitor and it was a movie. Literally looked like it was playing back a movie. And I remember I was like floored. I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So being able to, you know, have complete control over this image on the screen and, you know, sculpting light to, it's such a weird kind of concept to grasp, of just being able to shape light to, you know, craft these beautiful frames. And it's something, it's, you know, it's akin to painting, but just with a different kind of brush. Mm. So it's like, it's all artwork, but, it's just, you know, painting with light, really.
Right. When you started, you know, working on some bigger commercials, or maybe just starting to get to the point where you maybe had a gaffer, a grip, an AC, what was your biggest hurdle that you had to overcome? You know, something new. Like for me, lighting in general was the hardest thing for me to grasp. Just understanding the fundamentals of light took me so long to understand. I'm curious as to like, what about cinematography caused you the most, not stress, but like the biggest hurdle you had to overcome?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that the biggest hurdles for me are, that's a really good question.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, that one's interesting. I think, you know, going back to working with kind of larger crews, a lot of times you're put in these leadership positions by people that are like way older than you and that have much more experience than you too. So I think, I don't know that it was, if it was my biggest hurdle, but it was definitely a hurdle on, you know, accepting the fact that a lot of my department heads were a lot older than me. And, you know, it's easy to walk into this brand new set and working with a lot of these people the first time and them looking at you like, oh, who's this young buck DP? But then it's like, Right. Once you establish that rapport and once you give them a sense that you kind of know what you're doing, it's, I think a lot of that goes away really quickly. So, you know, a lot, and going back to confidence, it's like when we're doing a lot of these outdoor, big outdoor setups, it's like, I'm not gonna, you know, you have to be really, really confident and know exactly where you want to place this 20 by frame. Because these grips are just not gonna have it if you keep asking them to move that shit around, you know, every 2 minutes. Just, just can you move it this way? So it's like, you better be right the, you know, at least the second time, because after that, they're gonna be pretty fed up with you pretty quickly. So, yeah, it's going back to having confidence when you're making decisions on set. It's like, you know, not only do those decisions come a lot faster, but then, you know, you're also a lot more confident in those decisions that you're making. So,
absolutely. So I know that you do a lot of commercial, but you also do documentary. You said event stuff as well, being in Vegas. I'm curious, for people that are shooting commercials and maybe shooting documentaries, what attributes do you think being a DP that shoots commercials would translate really well to, you know, documentary shooting? Like, what do you think, like what foundations or fundamentals do you think in commercial shooting would better prepare you to be shooting documentary, or maybe even vice versa?
Yeah, that's also a really good question. A lot of my kind of background in general is in documentary work. So even when I was starting out in stills, I did a lot of photojournalism. And so it's almost like I had a leg up on a lot of other people who are starting out just from composition alone, because composition is such a difficult thing to teach. And especially in a documentary format when, you know, you can't control your subjects out in the real world. So you have to move your body and your camera to get the, you know, specific types of angles that you want, but also the angles that look good and also angles that, you know, tell the story in an appropriate manner. So it's like a lot of times, you know, back when I was first starting out, you know, I done a bunch of weddings. And so weddings are really good. Not that I don't do weddings anymore, but weddings I think are a really, really good way when you're first starting out to learn how to be, you know, super on your feet and just, they're super run and gun. It's like there are literally no second chances. And so you have to basically get it right on the first time. And right. a lot of those kind of principles transfer over to commercial work. It's like, you know, I want to get this take right on the first time. You know, if I don't, then give me one more chance. By the third time, there's probably another discussion that needs to be had. But, you know, and then from that sense, going from the commercial world, just kind of knowing how to light. That was my big thing. Transferring back over to documentary applications is, you know, which direction is your light coming from? What can we do to this room to kind of make it a little bit nicer, you know, in this documentary application? So they almost kind of go hand in hand and they can help one from the other. And so that's the kind of way that I approached it. So like I had a really big documentary background and then going into commercials, you know, I had a pretty good sense of composition and, you know, getting things right on the first take. And the thing that I had to work on, you know, was just basically lighting. And then that, again, just transfers over to a lot of the documentary work. So
Do you find that you have a stronger passion for one or the other, documentary or commercial?
I think I like commercials a little bit more. But that's a good question because I also really do like documentary work. Like here in Vegas, we have a ton of, you know, mixed martial arts stuff. We have the UFC here. We have PFL, right. a lot of boxing stuff. So those kinds of pieces are always super fun because we're just following around fighters like training all day. So that's, you know, their stories are always super interesting. And I always love documentaries as a medium, but, you know, commercials are nice because we have all of the crew to help facilitate, you know, all of our, you know, wants and needs. So that's a good question. It's probably a little bit of both. I would probably lean towards commercials, just because it's nice having that infrastructure to kind of create those images. And, the days are probably a little less strenuous depending on the commercial than documentaries, but, I'm curious, where do you land on the needle?
So documentaries are something that I don't do very often. I probably do 1 to 2 a year. I'd say 90% of my work is commercial, and then every so often I'll do more narrative short films. I think I love commercials. I really do. I think there's so much, I don't want to say fun because some of them are not, you know, super fun, but at the end of the day,
sure.
our job is to kind of make things look pretty. Like we have a really fun, awesome job and we get to, you know, get paid for it. And, I find that I think I kind of turned a corner recently in commercials where this past, you know, in 2024 and, end of 23, last quarter of 23, I find that all the commercials that I was on, I was given more creative freedom and flexibility than I ever have before. And I don't know if that was, you know, due to some of my previous work and just, you know, getting given more trust and people trust me more. But a lot of the commercials that I've done recently and have and are currently doing and will be doing soon, the amount of creative freedom that I'm given is truly amazing. So it feels like I've turned like a really pivotal corner in terms of my career in the commercial space. But documentaries are interesting. I did one last year in Kenya for a nonprofit organization. And it's a whole different feeling when you shoot something like that, when you know you're doing something good for humanity in a sense. Because we shot something for this nonprofit and the goal for that video was to be able to market it and be able to get enough funding for this nonprofit to buy a piece of property to house the boys that they were, you know, housing. That was the nonprofit. They're housing homeless teenage boys. And a couple months ago, I get a text from the founder of the nonprofit saying that they finally reached their goal and they bought 10 acres of land in Kenya. And now they could build their own house, build their own school, all those things. So it, for me, it was an amazing feeling knowing that something that we created helped something in real life.
You contributed to that.
It's amazing. Yeah. So it was really amazing. But I don't get that often because documentaries are few and far between for me. But I see why people find so much passion in that type of work, because it's real life you're shooting. And I think that's amazing.
Mm-hmm. And also going back to the skill sets kind of playing between one another, it's like knowing how to cover a scene in kind of a documentary format is super helpful. It's like you have one camera, you have two talent that you're recording a conversation. How and when and where do you switch your angle, your focal length, mm-hmm. your whatever? And how do you do that naturally in the middle, like during their conversation? Like, how do you do that to kind of, you know, make it seamless and make it invisible? And I think that's another skill set that also is kind of helps you think, make you think quick on your feet and in commercial applications as well. So.
Yeah, I think it really helps you dial in your like true fundamentals of cinematography, and even in the commercial space, understanding and how, you know, deep you know your fundamentals to be able to break those fundamentals to be able to have creative decisions in lighting for me has been huge. And it's as simple as an example of like doing interviews. Some people could look at interviews as being this super mundane thing that is just super basic, you know, do whatever. But whenever I shoot interviews, I always look at it as an opportunity to hone my craft even deeper. Like a lot of the times I'm walking into a location for the first time. How can I make this location look as good as it possibly can without any pre-knowledge of it at all? And that to me is a great exercise in really dialing in your fundamentals. And I think that's a great exercise for people to at least think about when they're working on like a mundane project. You have a ton of equipment, and I'm curious as to the importance on investments for you as a DP and just like business in general, how much weight you put into business, finance, and investments versus, you know, being a creative, because some creatives don't care about business. Others care about it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. And I think the landscape has kind of changed over the years, especially, you know, as we have a lot of owner operators kind of out and about, and me being one of them. And, you know, I like to look at my finances after every year, and I see that rentals account for, you know, well over half of my income. So it's like, from a financial perspective, you know, owning your own gear makes a lot of sense. And at the further I get in my career, the less and less it matters, the less I'm trying to rent out a lot of stuff. So it's almost like over the past few years, I've kind of shifted into not really trying to, even though I have a lot of the stuff, I'd rather not bring it. And I'd rather just show up and have, you know, all of my other key crew members kind of, you know, help handle that for me. And I think when you're first starting out, I think gear might matter a little bit more in that, you know, a lot of times when you're first starting out, you'll probably get hit up for these jobs where you need a camera, you need a basic lighting setup, and you need, you know, basic audio gear. So when you're first starting out, those, it kind of matters a little bit more. But then, you know, like I said, it's like I have a huge amount of lighting equipment, but on this big show I'm going on next week, I'm not bringing anything. So it's like at that level, it's also nice kind of spreading the love around to your crew, your other department heads who have that gear. Yep. It's like, you know, even though I'm a DP with, you know, X amount of sky panels, it's like, I'd rather my gaffer get that rental, and I'd rather my, you know, key grip get the rental for his truck. It's like, I'm not trying to cram camera, lighting, and grip into my small van. Like, I'd rather, if I can, just keep it to camera. So it's like, you know, being an owner operator, it's definitely, you know, definitely financially viable. It's just, it's difficult because you also have to maintain all your gear. And, you know, mm-hmm. in the event that, you know, one camera goes down and you need to send it in for repair, it's like, what are you using in the meantime? Like I just had to do that recently with my Alexa, and thankfully, you know, I have plenty of other cameras that can do, you know, just as good a job as that camera can. So, you know, 20 or so years ago, it's like you wouldn't really be asked what kind of camera package, producers wouldn't really ask you what camera packages do you own. It was more the conversations were a lot more creative than that. And ultimately that choice was kind of left to the DP to then choose a camera right for that specific project. And I, from an owner, from a DP standpoint, I still try to do that, even though I do own a lot of cameras, I own a lot of gear, I still try to bring the right tool out for that specific job. Right. And even though I am kind of financially motivated to bring out the bigger toys and the bigger cameras, it's like, at the end of the day, does that tool make sense for this job? And so just being hyper aware of that. And I always, you know, the good saying is, just because you can doesn't mean you should. And so I think once you, you know, are spoiled with, you know, bigger sets, bigger crews, nicer cameras and stuff like that, it's like, sometimes it might be easy to lose sight of, you know, a smaller FX3 or a little A7. And like, there's nothing wrong with those cameras. They just saw Creator on it. So it's like, what's the, you know, what's the big deal? So again, and it's like, will, you know, 12-bit or 16-bit XOCN really push the story forward in this corporate interview? It's like, probably not. There's probably a better tool. And so again, it's just kind of, you know, bringing it back down and kind of, you know, focusing on back on, you know, what tool would best serve the story.
Right. I want to shift again into something, last topic, is something that I'm personally curious, is your journey in YouTube. Because I think we're both at a very similar place in the YouTube, you know, community. What motivated you to start YouTube, and why, what motivates you to keep doing it?
Yeah, so I did my first video, I probably in 2016. It was, I just got a new small HD monitor. It was the small HD 502. Super excited about it. And I just did an unboxing and just did like a little video on it. And even before that, like way long, long before that, I had always wanted to, I had always been fascinated by YouTube and the idea of having like a weekly show, or like, you know, a, however many, or just any show in general, just your own video that you can put out that people will come to watch you. Like, I've always been fascinated by that. And even when I was, a little bit younger, and I had always told myself, you know, it would be really cool to do that. And then one day it just clicked on me, and it's like, wait, what am I talking about? I have all this video equipment. I could literally do that. What am I? Hello. So then I just start, so then I made this, small HD 502 review video, and it was just super fun. Just the being able to, you know, create some, you know, it's the same thing that we do, what we do as a DP. It's just being able to kind of create your own video. And I had put it out, not really looking for a lot of views. I didn't really post it anywhere. Like, I did it just for me. And I think YouTube is a place for me where, at the end of the day, I'm the end client, and I kind of get the final say, and I get to be the person that doesn't have to say that it looks too dark. You know, I can have complete and total control. And it's a avenue for me to where I can, you know, flush out all of my creative angst and, you know, not get penalized for it. And so the way that I approach YouTube, and my goal for YouTube, was to always never have any goals for YouTube. And so that's why I think that I kind of still consider my channel a kind of on the smaller end, on the, I guess, more underground level, as compared to some other YouTubers who have just been skyrocketing their growth and their engagement. It's been just absolutely insane. And it's fun for me to watch too. It's like, I don't, you know, part of me, you know, does envy that a little bit, but then, you know, so I always go back to being, well, it's like, well, why am I creating YouTube videos at the end of the day? And no matter, and even though I might have sponsorships, I might have, you know, collaborations with other brands, and those are always super fun, but at the end of the day, the videos that I'm creating for YouTube are literally for me. I probably watch my videos way more than any other subscriber. So like, I'll upload a video, I'll throw it up, I will watch it all day. And I'm like, dude, that was cool. That was sick. That's a good video. So it's
I'm so opposite. I edit and I never watch it again.
Really? No. Yeah, no, I learned to take pride in, you know, cause it's, you know, again, it's this creation that you were able to make. And I don't necessarily do that with every video. Not every video is like that, but when the edit hits right and the music is coming in, and, I think one of the recent videos that I really, really enjoyed for myself was I did a review of this Nanlux light, and it was right after I'd watched my Oppenheimer Blu-ray. So a lot of it was a lot of times I'll get inspired by big movies like Dune or Oppenheimer. And then for my next YouTube video, I'll try to kind of put little hints and homages to those epic movies in something as silly as a YouTube video. So right. Even though that, you know, I'm not trying to get a lot of views. I'm not trying to get a lot of subscribers. I'm really at the end of the day, just kind of doing it for me. And so it's always funny whenever I see people in the comments, they'll just leave, you know, mean comments or whatever. And I'm like, dude, I don't care. Guess what? I literally don't care. So it's kind of neat in that regard. So, but even lately, so for me, I don't know how it's been for you. I'm curious actually, but for me lately, work has been kind of a little bit slow, and it's been for me, and I think a lot of other people in LA, it's been pretty dry. So over the past, I guess, year, maybe half a year, I've kind of come to realize how viable YouTube and content creation is as a financial income stream. So, you know, again, it's part of that is almost forcing me to make goals for myself for YouTube and forcing me to actively pursue this just for those lulls when I don't have a lot of work. So,
right,
you know,
right.
It's an avenue again where I can continue to be creative, but also, you know, make a decent amount of money. So, it's easy to poke fun at a lot of influencers and content creators, but at the end of the day, they're getting that bag and some of them are really successful at doing it. So,
yeah, for sure. Do you see yourself committing to YouTube full time ever and stopping DP?
No, never. I would never consider going full time ever. Again, going back to my goal is to never have any goals. And part of that is, I always want YouTube to take the back seat because a lot of my information that I give on YouTube is based off of my real world job. So it's like, if I don't have that, then, you know, I'm not sure the value that I'll be able to provide on YouTube. And even now you have all these great DPs on YouTube that are doing exactly that. They're providing a lot of their great insights from on set. And so it's like, it's easy to talk about a lens and in, you know, this, your own little YouTube cave, but without actually using it on set, it's like, how much would you take a lot of that insight into account? So it's interesting, but for me, YouTube will always and forever take the back seat. That's why, like, I sometimes won't even post for 3 months. Like, I just posted my first video like last week in literally since December. So, again, I don't have any goals for it. I'm not trying to upload once a week, once a day, whatever. It's like I'm gonna let it be what it is and kind of let it grow organically. And, you know, that's just me personally. So, but
yeah. I have the similar mentality that when people ask me what I want out of YouTube, I don't really have a defined answer because I don't really know what I don't really know what my relationship to YouTube is still. Like, I really don't know what it is. I think I also don't have as strict of goals with YouTube as I do DP work. And I could notice it within, like, I get more envious of people's work in the DP realm, but if people are blowing up on YouTube, I honestly don't even like think twice about it. Like, I'm not that I'm not stoked about people blowing up in DP work or, like, you know, YouTube, but I don't feel any envy about people blowing up past me or whatever the case may be. But yeah, I don't really have any strong goals for YouTube. I enjoy it. It's really tough though to be consistent, especially, you know, being, you know, working as
it's
a DP.
Really easy to, it's really easy to see how it can quickly become a full-time job.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think you and me, it's like, I post when I can, and I'm sure you do as well. And even that is like, it takes so much time and effort just to put out a good video. And, you know, I can see how literally this can consume you. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It's like, you know, you can go full-time and you can make a great deal of money just being a content creator. But, you know, then again, you see a lot of these big YouTube names kind of announcing that they're quitting or they're stopping just because
the burnout,
because they've become burnt out. So it's like, you know, it's really interesting. And again, I think for me, it's just like, I'd rather just kind of keep it fun. And I'd just like any other passion, I'd rather just do it when I can and love when I am doing it so that there is none of that resentment towards, oh, I have to make a YouTube video. It's like, I want to make a YouTube video, you know? So it's,
right.
It's interesting.
I think I had that mentality for a while. I was like, oh, I have to make another one this week to get it up by Monday. And then I think I switched because I realized I couldn't keep that. I was like, I'm just going to do it when I can. Like, who is pressuring me to put one up once a week other than myself? And it's killing me to do
exactly.
that. It's the video quality is going down. I'm drained. I have no creative energy anymore. It's just, there's nothing positive about this at all. So I try to do maybe once a month, twice a month, most now. And I try to come in it with a bit more of a positive mentality. Like, I get to do this and I get to share it in front of, you know, thousands of people now. And it's a really amazing thing that we get to do that. So, yeah, I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's really fun. And then, or you could be like Lewis Potts and put out one video a month and just get in crazy, crazy engagement.
You know, I was in LA last year and I got coffee with Lewis and we spoke. This is the longest coffee. We spent 3 hours at a coffee shop, I think. And he's exactly the same. He's exactly the same in the video. He's really great. And I think he's an anomaly in the YouTube space. Like, he doesn't have to do much and it just works. Whatever he does.
That's
just works.
Exactly to your point. I remember, so I had just said that I don't really envy people that have crazy engagement, but I envy people like Lewis and Blaine who can just put out videos and they're so carefree, but they're so good and excellent. And it's just their personality. It's pure personality. And to me, as an audience, their on-screen presence is so carefree, so nonchalant, but their videos are so good. And I feel like for me, I just have a different, I guess, YouTube style, but I envy that level of chillness. I love their videos and I love watching them for sure.
Right.
And you as well. Sometimes, you know, I'll watch you and you're, you know, just talking about life and it's just like, man, this video is so chill. I feel like mine videos can get a little overproduced and a little, you know, this, that, and that, the other, but, you know, I think that's the beauty of what we do is that there's no right or wrong way to do things. So,
yeah, I think, I don't know, I've tried experimenting a little bit in the types of videos and, it's also become like those type of videos that you're referencing have been like a form of therapy for me. Like if I'm going through something in my life and I post that video or you see a video of that style, just know that I'm probably going through something in my life that I just needed to let out.
Yeah, it's a good form of release for sure. Yeah, it's very,
and I know it's helped people too because it's helped people, you know, make them feel like they're not alone as well. Because what I go through is similar to what a lot of people go through as well. And, you know, I had a conversation with somebody and, you know, a lot of people could look at us, you know, having thousands of subscribers doing big DP work and think that we have everything figured out. But I think for me to be able to share some of my, you know, faults or, you know, issues that I'm going on, I think it creates a bit of relatability for people that otherwise wouldn't really be able to feel that, I guess.
Totally. And that's something that I think about all the time is that like a lot of people, it's easy for a lot of people to kind of base our lives based off our Instagram pages. And so whenever I meet someone in real life or really anyone, I always tell them, listen, my life is a lot more boring than what it looks like on Instagram. Yeah. If there's anything to learn from me, it's that my life is definitely not that cool. I'm not always in Miami filming whatever. I'm not always in LA doing big jobs. It's like sometimes I do go through the mundane. And it's funny. I got a recent comment on one of my YouTube videos. The guy said, richest camera guy on YouTube. And I'm like, dude, what the heck? Just because I have a new camera means I'm the richest camera guy on YouTube. It's like,
I get that a lot when I put anything about the Venice. But if I put anything about the Venice up, the people come flocking about cost and like money. It's just, it's insane.
It's pretty wild. So it's pretty easy for me to turn off my comment notifications. But I mean, on the flip side too, a lot of times we get really great comments that kind of help us keep going at the same time. Yeah. So, and again, those comments are always super helpful and kind of, re-encouraging that, we're fighting the good fight. And, again, I try to always kind of go at it at kind of a low level, no goals kind of approach, but, having good comments like that are pretty good affirmations.
Right. I got one last question for you. It's kind of geared towards more of an advice question. I guess if you want to think, I don't know if it would be, going back to high school when you had the camera around your neck. It could be at a particular point when you were starting to pursue DP work with the intention of being a DP. And you, where you currently are sitting in a chair, and across from you is that version of you years prior. What advice would you give that younger version of you as you start to intentionally pursue DP work?
I would tell them to, that's a good question. I feel like I heard you ask this question to someone else and I was like,
it's my go-to ender usually. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel it's, like I've it heard stumps you ask
people.
This before.
It stumps people quite a bit. Yeah.
That's a good one. I would first and foremost tell them not to buy the Narbox 2.0. That thing is a piece of garbage and you do not need it. And second of all, I would probably tell that person to just trust their instincts. And I think I've been pretty, I think I've had a pretty solid approach from my upbringing. And a lot of that can be attributed to my cinematography mentor back when I was in film school. And if it weren't for him, I don't think I would be the position I'm in. And I can almost kind of attribute everything I've done and kind of trace it all back to him because he kind of laid the foundation and my approach to visual storytelling as a medium. So everything that I've done, since film school, I've kind of had and taken that approach. So, which has ultimately led me here. So I don't know that I would necessarily change anything. I would just tell myself to keep following your instincts. You're on the right path and go get them.
Amazing. Awesome. Do you want to plug any of your social media? Feel free to share whatever you got.
I got Instagram. I got YouTube. Robert Machado. That's
not the
about
surfer.
It. Follow me. Yeah, not the surfer. I make videos every once in a while, but
yeah. Rockstar, yeah, dude. You kill it.
Yeah.
You do.
Well, that's
thank
about
you,
all I got. Yeah.
All right.
No problem. Thanks
thank
for having
you.
Me. This was
yeah,
this
thanks
fun.
For coming on. All right. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day. Peace out. So thank you for tuning into another episode of the Creative Gap Podcast. Hopefully you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, there are a ton of other episodes for you to listen to as well. Check us out on Spotify, Google Play, Apple Podcasts, wherever you want to get your podcast, you can find it. And now that you're watching this, you could also watch the full video podcast on YouTube. Also, be sure to check us out on Instagram @CreativeGap for future updates, upcoming guests, and a lot of short clips. For those of you who are new to the show, welcome. Hopefully you enjoy it. And for those of you who have been here for a long time, thank you. So that's all we got for you today. Hopefully you enjoyed the episode. We'll see you next time. Peace out.